for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Special Olympics began 4 decades ago as a backyard day camp at the home of Eunice Kennedy Shriver. Today, it's a global organization with nearly 3 million intellectually disabled participants. We'll talk about the history and the future of Special Olympics and how it's changed attitudes and lives. Joining me in the studio, Tom Songster, Special Advisor to the Special Olympics, George Jeschen. He's Executive Director of the Association of University Centers on Disabilities. David Egan, he's a Special Olympian born with Down syndrome. And Kathleen Egan, David's mother. I do invite your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Don't forget, you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. Tom Songster, let me start with you. You knew Kennedy, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, for more than 40 years. Tell us what she was like.
Well, I was had the very good fortune to be a professor of sport and recreation for people with disabilities. And Mrs. Shriver literally sort of picked me out from among a group of people who were interested in helping work with people in those days with intellectual disabilities. And literally from the first time I met Mrs. Shriver, there was no choice that I was compelled to be with her in work and continued to organize the Special Olympics program in Indiana.
What do you mean you were compelled to work with
her?
Well,
because of her personality and specifically her will to do certain things. And sometimes, even in the 40 years, I imagined that maybe, you know, maybe that is not possible. But that word never would ever enter Mrs. Shriver's mind. And she wouldn't say, why not? She wouldn't question. She'd just say, it's possible.
George Jeschen, you knew her as well. What do you remember of her?
Well, I had been fortunate to have been named a Joseph P. Kennedy Policy Fellow back in 94, 95, and had the fortune to work in the Senate as a policy fellow on disability legislation. I then went back home to Wisconsin, and a year later, the position of executive director at the Joseph P. Kennedy Foundation opened up, and people asked me to apply, and I ended up with the position and had the great honor of working for her for a number of years in the late 90s. You know, one of the things that just sort of strikes me of that time is when you're here in Washington, there are a lot of people who have a lot of responsibility, who have a lot of power, and you meet them, you talk, you work with them. But as soon as you came into a room with Mrs. Shriver, you knew that you were with an extraordinary person who had this bedrock commitment to people with disabilities that was just evident in every word and every action. And you sort of counted the moments that you had with her because you realized you were in such an extraordinary situation.
And, of course, her sister, Rosemary, really began to elevate this whole idea of intellectual disability in Ms. Shriver. Did she talk about Rosemary very much?
Oh, very, very much. That's a very important point about Rosemary. She was a part of the family In all of my 40 years of experience with Mrs. Shriver, she came to Christmas parties when the Kennedy family still had their home in Florida. She always went there for the holidays. Mrs. Shriver, of course, had her to her home, her and Mr. Shriver's home many times. She went to the Cape, like all of the rest of, quote, the Kennedys, for the summer vacation. And she was really quite an interesting woman. And, of course, you see the photographs when she was young. She was, you know, quite beautiful. And as Mrs. Shriver is, she was a very determined person in her later lives. She paid visits and made visits to some of the Smithsonians and so on. She was she was really determined to see what was going on.
And of course, in her early 20s, she was forced to have a lobotomy by her father for reasons I think that have never been quite clear, but I gather Mrs. Shriver, then Eunice Kennedy, was very, very supportive and sympathetic to her sister.
Well, I think, you know, again, I can't speak about that because that was obviously before those 40 years, but I know this, that Mrs. Shriver, with all of her family, I think they looked at her as the maternal manager of the family. I can't speak again on behalf of Senator Kennedy, but, you know, I think Mrs. Shriver was always the touchstone of what was really going on. Where were they really going to have this Christmas party or birthday party? You always had to make sure that you got Mrs. Shriver's check out.
Tom Songster, special advisor to the Special Olympics, and George Jeschen. He is executive director of the Association of University Centers on Disabilities. Turning now to you, David Egan, in the midst of a yawn, I catch you. Tell us how you first became associated with Special Olympics.
I started at Special Olympics at the age of 8 when I first started with my family. At the time, I didn't know much about my disability as much, but I can tell with Eunice Shriver, she's definitely opened so many doors, and I can tell you that I have broken through all those doors since I can look back from my being 8 years old, and I'm now 31 years old now.
You actually met Mrs. Kennedy Shriver, did you not?
Yes, I have.
And what kind of exchange did you have with her?
Well, I also spoke to some of the members of her family, like Maria Shriver and Tim Shriver. And I just have to tell you, just coming from me as an athlete and as a person, it's really great to have a family like that who knows people with disabilities very well. And it's really great to interact with them because you don't often hear about people with disabilities for them to be on the spotlight. And it's really great how Eunice did that.
I think that's wonderful. Tell me what kind of sports activities you got into early on.
When I was 8, I first started in track and field.
Track and field.
But then I kind of moved out of track and field into the sport of swimming.
Ah.
And swimming is one of my favorite sports.
That's great.
I also compete in basketball and soccer. My dad is the coach of my soccer team. And a friend of mine by the name of Parker Ramsdale, who's also a high school volunteer coach of mine, who coached me for swimming.
David Egan. He's a Special Olympian born with Down syndrome. Tell us where you work, David.
I work at a company called Booz Allen Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody there knows me.
And you enjoy working there.
Yes, I do. I really do. The people there really know me very well. The clients, and the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis in the distribution center. In fact, I could tell you right now they're probably listening to the show.
Let's hope so.
I would certainly think so. And that's David Egan. Now to his mother, Kathleen Egan. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell me how you decided to become involved with Special Olympics.
Oh, when David was born, you know, we were at the university in Wisconsin. And when a child with a disability is born, I, as a mother, you're questioning yourself. You think of, you know, you get a little bit of a guilt trip on yourself. And then you try to think of all the wrong things, you know, that you need to fix. And I think what I learned when I met the Special Olympics, that it's not about disabilities. It's really about the capabilities of David. And so I learned with the Special Olympics to celebrate David, not to try to fix anything. There's nothing to fix. There's something to celebrate. And just, I think, Eunice and the Shrivers and the Special Olympics, what they've shown us is that our values have to be about people, not about standards of terms of expectations in society sometimes are, and I was a PhD student, my husband was a PhD student, so intellectual excellence was kind of priority for us, you know. So having a child with disability brings you humility, brings you a sense of life is more than just material success or intellectual success. It's about accepting who you are as you are. You know, and then the other thing that I love about Special Olympics is they give you a goal, a short goal that you can achieve.
Kathleen Egan, David's mother. She has a PhD in educational psychology. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking about Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who died yesterday, as well as the extraordinarily important organization she established, Special Olympics. Here in the studio, four people. Tom Songster, he's special advisor to the Special Olympics. George Jeschen, he's executive director of the Association of University Centers on Disabilities. David Egan, he's a Special Olympian born with Down syndrome. He works as a mailroom distribution clerk at Booz Allen Hamilton in McLean, Virginia. And Kathleen Egan, David's mother. She has a PhD in educational psychology. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Tom, you were there from the beginning. How did the Special Olympics actually get started?
Well, through the support of the Chicago Park and Recreation Department in 1968, meetings some people might remember Sergeant Shriver was actually head of the merchandising mart in Chicago, but he was also president of the Chicago School Board. And so they had, obviously, the connections within the Mayor Daley programs as a mayor and so on. And so Chicago still today and in those days was one of the leading park and recreation departments in the country. And Mrs. Shriver had this idea about having a competition. They said, Chicago, we can do that, just like they're getting ready for the Olympics. And so in 1968, they sent out invitations to centers around the United States, institutions in those days for the mentally retarded, sent it to the Association for Retarded Citizens, which was an association that still exists today that works with families and so on to support these programs. And as a result of that, 1,000 individuals showed up in Chicago for what was the first and now historic Special Olympic Games.
And where were they held?
Well, they were held in the Soldier Field of all places. I mean, today you see this modern, very fancy stadium, but inside that stadium now still is a plaque commemorating, first of all, the 30th anniversary of Special Olympics. And Mayor Daley's son, of course, was there to commemorate the 30th anniversary. We're just celebrating this year the 40th anniversary on Mrs. Shriver's
But path. What about the story we've all heard that the first Special Olympics was actually held in Mrs. Shriver's backyard?
Well, the origin.
Kathleen, go ahead.
I haven't seen the first one, but I've been in her home. She invites the Special Olympians to go and spend the summer there and participate in swimming, tennis, basketball. And it's like family, you know?
It's like family.
Yes, very much so.
Do you all feel that way?
Well, even more so, because in the beginning, the family, meaning Timothy Shriver, Maria Shriver, and Anthony Shriver was just a baby, were part of the volunteer group that were Mrs. Shriver literally plucked out of the high schools and area here to help the more than 100 participants. And just as a quick follow-up, after Mrs. Shriver, quote-unquote, really retired from the board and so on, she decided in 2003 that we should bring the Special Olympics Camp Shriver back to life. Mm-hmm. And so from 2004 to 2008, we ran Camp Shriver again. I'm not sure, David, if it was more fun than the beginning, but I know those of us that were there, it was pretty fun, and glad you could come out.
I could say either way on how it started. In at the camp, it really shows something about Una Shriver and all of our athletes and all the people that have been coming in, cheering our athletes on all the time. As an athlete myself, it's always a dream for an athlete to meet Eunice Kennedy Shriver because of her life and legacy and what she had left behind. Mm. And I think in her family, I think there's a big, what I wanted to say is that this family is very supportive, just like any other family for that matter.
You know, we've had an email from a person who says, while a student at Penn State, I served as a hugger at the Special Olympics. My role was simply to hug the Olympians after each had crossed the finish line. What a joy. This is from Kathleen in Ann Arbor. You must recall seeing many of those huggers.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, like David said, the Eunice Shriver family is leading us by example. So we as a family now, all of us, you know, David has another brother and two sisters, and all of them now are also volunteers, and they are fans of the Special Olympics.
Kathleen, you talked about the fact that the Special Olympics program really changed your thinking, changed your outlook. Talk about those early days before you and your family reached Special Olympics and what it was like for you to go through those years.
Well, David is 31 years old. So 30 plus years ago, people, I had never met someone with a disability when I had David. He was my first child. So in fact, I denied it. I told the doctors to all go away and that they had the wrong baby, you know. David was beautiful, but they kept telling me he has 47 syndromes, the symptoms are there and so on. So they were fixated on, well, I was at the university, so he became an object of research. In fact, we had researchers, cardiologists listening to his heart. He has a ventricle septentrial defect, and he has all the symptoms of a person with Down syndrome. I never thought David would be able to be on radio, on NPR. I never thought he would be a SOVA board member. I never thought he would be an advocate for people with disabilities. I thought my life was over, you know, and no more children. It's over. I did something wrong. I brought into the world the wrong child, you know. However, with Special Olympics, I turned the page around. Instead of thinking of researching what's wrong, I began researching what can be done.
But what was it that helped you to
seeing
do that?
Him on the, in the field, seeing him accepted, you know, seeing him running, seeing him do the 25 meters first, then getting to the 50 meters, then to the individual medley. He had goals, and the goals were achievable. The goals were feasible. And it's not about winning. It's about each time excelling a little bit, you know. So you take what you have, and you make the most of what you have. And so many of us take for granted what we have. I think when you have a child who has a disability and can do, you begin thinking, my God, everybody has a contribution to make. It doesn't matter how small, how large. And I think what UNICEF has shows us is little successes, little ones. Because I know David is high functioning, David is very capable, and he says that many other adults or children maybe have not had the chances that David has had. But still, even that person who can barely make it in the water, I think what was special about Special Olympics, doesn't matter if you can do it in less than a minute. Can you do it? What can you do? I think that's, I think, the most important message. And then always do a little more than what you did the last time. I think.
Well, you were very convincing with that statement, because that's what Mrs. Shriver really believed in. She really focused not only on those, but focused more on the individuals who were at the other end as well. Mm-hmm. We always had some athletes that were always way over the top. But in this case here, we organized a program, a motor activities training program, which is for those individuals who are not quite ready for Special Olympics. And always they were included. They're included in our World Games, in our National Games, the State Games, all the different levels. And I'm sure, David, you've seen some of them.
I have to say that I have. And over the years when I first started in my public speaking, I started at a very young age, from an elementary school, but now doing more speeches for Special Olympics really gave me a whole new way of thinking, a different perspective that you don't often think that people with disabilities can have. I started in 1999 volunteering for the North Carolina World Games, and that's how it all started from there.
So you started out as a volunteer, and then you began to participate yourself.
Yeah, I'm an athlete all year round, but I also have many different hats that I wear now, because of being an athlete myself, being a board member, volunteer, you name it. I can tell you, in Special Olympics, everyone's a winner, and you see that every single time when Eunice Kennedy Shriver comes out and supports all of us.
David, you are indeed a winner, and I am proud to have you here on the program.
Thank you.
George Jeschen, I'd like to understand the Association of University Centers on Disabilities. When was that formed, and what are your functions?
Well, you know, it's interesting listening to the accomplishments of Special Olympics and Eunice's role as founding it. And one would think that that was to go from a backyard camp to a movement that includes millions of people across the world would certainly be enough accomplishment for a lifetime. And it's really one of the major accomplishments of Eunice Kennedy Shriver that through her efforts, for example, back in the 60s, there were very few people who understood what caused disabilities, what kinds of supports and services could be provided to provide explanations to families, to mothers and fathers of very young children, as well as of adult children with disabilities. Through her efforts, she actually was instrumental in beginning what's now called the Eunice Kennedy Shriver Institute mm-hmm. on Child Health and Human Development. Prior to her efforts, there was, as I understand it, one pediatrician in the entire NIH looking at the issues of young children. Through her efforts, we now have literally thousands of scientists across this country, here in Bethesda, and around the world studying what can we do to optimize the development of young children.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, and first let's go to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning, Harold. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I have a vignette. It goes back to early 1964. The mental health planning was ending. The retardation planning was beginning. I ran both of them for the Commonwealth. The governor at that time was Endicott Peabody. I got a call from him complaining bitterly about the fact that Eunice was driving him crazy, and
that's
I had to do something about it. And so I found out that there was a particular individual who was on the commissioner of the department, and who was probably a consultant to her father on Rosemary, and so I arranged that he would move over to the side. But to make sure that everything happened, two of the people, our key actors, one our legal counsel and one our ethics chairman, Bob Drinan and Bill Curran, met regularly as informal consultants to Eunice. Everything worked out fine. We never heard another word from her. But she really followed through.
That's interesting. And, of course, she was very instrumental in having her brother, President Kennedy, establish the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development.
Definitely. And, yeah, we were there when the name was changed from mental retardation to intellectual disabilities at the NIH. That was a great moment.
That was the first time that I've met everybody in the Eunice Kennedy Shriver family. I also went to their house in Maryland as well, too.
And as part of that legacy, where once there was nothing, there's now a center in every single state dedicated to the study and the training and the provision of supports for children and adults with intellectual and other developmental disabilities. This entire network called the University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities really owes its existence to her perseverance, to her, as the caller mentioned, driving people crazy until they were moved to action. What was interesting, I think, about Eunice's style is she was brilliant in understanding that it was individuals and people who made decisions, and that they made decisions partially based on attitude and emotion, but also based on fact and science. And she would always try to find out who was the best mind in a particular area, who had dedicated his or her life to an issue. And she'd want that person in her office talking to her about what the issue really is, what's the promise, what's the hope for the future. And then with that information, she was absolutely brilliant and astute in identifying the individual who she could talk to with that scientific information to move them to action. It was really incredible to watch. And I know Tom probably saw this happen over and over again throughout her tenure.
Well, I did. And I want to add to your point here that also, many people from outside the USA have now use the services of the institute, or you know, of the institute, because many of these families, unfortunately, in their respective countries, don't have the opportunity to find doctors. And of course, the Kennedy Foundation, which Mrs. Shriver served as the executive vice president of the Kennedy Foundation, provided financial resources to bring professors, medical doctors, and so on here to study at these various institutions here in America so that this could even be utilized outside the USA.
She certainly was a remarkable woman, mm-hmm. a powerful woman mm-hmm. who brought her talents to where she felt they were most needed. And we all send our condolences to the family and regret her passing. Tom Songster, George Jeschen, David Egan, and Kathleen Egan. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Civil discourse today is in danger of being shouted down by talking heads and closed-minded extremists. How to be passionate without becoming a fanatic. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We're talking about Special Olympics, the accomplishments of Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who passed away yesterday. And we have a number of people in the studio who are more than happy to talk with you about Special Olympics and their own accomplishments. Let's go now to Malka in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a daughter who's 4 years old who has Down syndrome. And I just was wondering how David Egan has such a beautiful speech, what he did to be so clear as he's speaking. It's, as I said, he has beautiful speech.
It's wonderful, and, isn't it?
Yes.
David didn't speak early on. He spoke at the age of 3. He's the first of 4 children. His sister, Teresa, taught him to speak.
Interesting.
And he had, you know, people with Down syndrome like to imitate. And so we started very early on to have David in a work group, play group, in my own home with friends of mine. So having a child with Down syndrome around other children who talk and speak, the child with Down syndrome has excellent memory and great ability to mimic. So you don't want a child with Down syndrome only listening to other people with disabilities. That helped David quite a bit. And also eating everything, you know. Many parents don't have their children eat hard food or so finger food, have them chew on things, make sure all the muscles are working properly, and reading to them. I read to David since the first day, you know. I read him poetry, and he loves poetry. And
now, so, Malka, let me ask you a question. Is your daughter in any kind of play group?
Oh, yes. I have her in a special school where it's inclusion. Half the kids are special needs, and are what they call, and the other half are called typical children. Mm-hmm. And I also have her in a private school when I'm able to do that half of the day. So half of the full day she's in school. And I do keep her very active, and she, thank God, is very high-functioning. But her speech, of course, is a real challenge, and we're working hard on it. But I do agree with you. She does like to mimic, and she loves she loves to talk, even if we don't understand her.
Let her talk. Let her talk and talk back. And don't try to, if you don't understand her, say, I don't understand. I remember my husband with David, he would say, bah, that he wanted the bottle for a long, long time.
Wow.
So John would say, well, you mean bottle? You know, so you give feedback to the child and they learn. But on the other hand, if that's not the unique ability of your child, look for other abilities. Not all people with disabilities have the same capabilities.
David, do you remember struggling to learn to talk?
I can remember more or less a few things, but hearing it from my mom, talking to this caller, I could tell that I just get flashbacks every time I am at that age. I could tell you that it wasn't really easy at first to begin with, and I know every parent probably would have to try to deal with it in their own way in that situation that they may be in, but it's no different. I mean, all families are all the same. It's kind of like, just like with the Eunice Kennedy Shriver family, we're all one in the same. Working together and winning together, too.
And Kathleen, you talked about the example of the Kennedy family.
Yeah, that inspired us. So my husband and I said, we're going to engage all of our children in this Special Olympics. So my daughter Teresa, my daughter Miranda were coaches for figure skating. They love swimming and they helped with swimming. My son Mark, the youngest, who's 19, was in the unified sports with softball. We're all involved. My daughter Miranda volunteered for Special Olympics International. She went to China. So it's opened the horizon for our family. And I think that's the model that I think Eunice wanted. She gave it to Tim and her other children. And I hope that Tim and Maria Shriver and the rest of the family will continue, and each one of us families will help them keep that movement to be a global movement, an international movement, because we're lucky in the United States. That's not the case in many other countries.
Let's go now to Jerry in Long Island, New York. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Certainly.
As usual, your show is wonderful.
Thank you.
I would like to say to David that he is a wonderful young man, and he must be proud of himself, and his parents must be very proud of him. But my comment is this. I'm going to be 71 in a few months. When I was growing up, there was a girl that lived around the corner from us, and whenever her mother, I assume it was her mother, would stand her outside at the leaning up against the wall of their apartment building, and whenever we passed by, my mother would say, don't look, don't look, don't look, you know. And so I grew up with a false, what's the word, whatever, you know, of people with disabilities, and we used to call them mongoloids. And then as I got older and I realized, I said, oh, my God, we were really ignorant and stupid people, you know. And my late sister-in-law had a cousin who was mentally handicapped, and they did not do well by that boy. They treated him like he was supposed to be a normal child, and if he did something wrong, his father would beat him. You know, it was really, really disgusting.
Well, Jerry, I think you have pointed out very eloquently precisely how attitudes have changed, and much of that is thanks to Eunice Kennedy Shriver.
Definitely, definitely. But also, I think we need the media to portray more the people with abilities, you know. We don't see the faces of the athletes.
Because when, they were told
exactly,
not to look.
Exactly. In fact, 30 years ago, I looked in all the books, in the psychology books. The pictures were horrible. And I was working at the time at the University of Wisconsin with the medical school and the nurse practitioners. And one of them was writing a book for obstetrics. I gave her pictures of David, the most beautiful pictures I could find, because I wanted the world to know that they are beautiful, you know, because the pictures that are there in the scientific books are ugly. So I don't blame you for wanting to hide. And many times, even at the very beginning, when people would ask me how old is David and he was so little, you know, I wouldn't want to talk, you know, because people were not accepting. We're more accepting now. And I think in the U.S. we've come a long way accepting people with disabilities.
Kathleen, were you ever advised not to have more children?
Yeah. No, not to have more children. I was advised to put David in an institution.
You were?
Yes. My husband and I said, go, forget it. That's my son. I'll take care of him, you know. So,
that's my dad.
My husband and I think that was the night where I saw him cry the most. I was advised for that. And I was scared of having other children. That was true. I was scared to death. But then David showed me, don't be scared, Mom. And so I have three beautiful children. David is the first and he's number one. And all the others, I think, are learning from him.
Well, I don't really think, just the way that my mom said it, with me being number one in everything, it's not just that, I'm not sure that's the only thing about being number one. I think being number one is not like using the word number one. I kind of like consider myself the last person. In some ways, because of my family, because we're so supportive and everything, and in my family, we're so competitive. And so that's why I have to be number one.
That's a great story, David. I'm glad you said that. Jerry, thanks for your call. Now to Juanita in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Diane Reem?
Yes.
I listen to you every day. You're my favorite. I love you.
Thank you.
I grew up in a handicapped school here in San Antonio, and it's called Eloise Yasset, and it's now a public school, but when I was growing, it was strictly for the handicapped, and a lot of my friends had participated in these Special Olympics. We are now in our 50s, I called all my friends to let them know, you know, and they told me to call you. So I just wanted to say thank you. My heart goes out to the family of the Shrivers. And I read a lot about Mrs. Shriver, and she was really awesome. And I really wanted to know if she had ever known Miss Eloise Yasset, who was also a wonderful person with the handicapped people. Does anybody know?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak directly to that of who whether Mr. Shriver knew her, but I know that our program in the El Paso area has always been very strong. In fact, the former board president of Texas Special Olympics, Rick McCarty, is from the El Paso area. He worked there at one of the centers in El Paso. So I don't know her, but I know that there has always been a strong program from the El Paso area.
All right. Thanks for your call, Juanita. And to Bethesda, Maryland. Hi there, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I am a parent of a little guy named Jeffrey. He's 16. He has Down syndrome. He's a Special Olympics athlete. And because of Mrs. Shriver, he has a sense of competition that's just amazing. And, you know, so I thank her for that. And my question really is for George. With all of the barriers that Mrs. Shriver has broken in terms of attitudes and presenting and celebrating people with intellectual disabilities, how have you seen her advancements in those areas on your own network? How do you involve people with disabilities in all of the university centers?
George.
Great question. You know, one of the things that I think Mrs. Shriver did was always check out the expert and scientific opinions with moms and dads. She always wanted them there at meetings. When she traveled, she always wanted to meet with parents. And I think intuitively, she, in a way, was a precursor of what's happening throughout this country, of a very strong family-centered orientation that's growing up, and that hopefully our new professionals, those that are now being trained at universities, understand the central role of parents and their critical, they provide the context for development. I think Kathleen and David are just a perfect example of the evolution of what is really becoming the standard of practice in our profession as we deal with disabilities, of making sure that parents are there every step of the way as full partners in research, in training, and in the development of services.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And here is an email from Miriam. She's in Fort Worth, Texas. She says, I have a nephew who is autistic, and he has participated in the Special Olympics. I just have to say, God bless Eunice Shriver. To see these beautiful people participate is a wonderful experience. It brought tears to my eyes to see my beautiful nephew run track and the smile he had on his face when he received his medal is priceless. You must have had many of the same experiences,
yes,
Kathleen.
David has a room full of medals.
I'm sure.
But he also says in his speeches, it's more than about the medals. It's giving it your best. You know?
Well, I kind of put it this way. It's more than medals and awards. In addition to that, and I agree with my mom that really it really shows how Special Olympics can really go above and beyond anyone's expectations, and the expectations of others too. When people think they're being discriminatory with people with other disabilities, it's no different. We're all the same, and we. And all I'm saying to all of you is that let's really think through this and say, you know, we're all the same, but at the same time, we should open our minds to a different way of doing things. It's all about the abilities and not really the disability, and that's what matters the most, and that's what shows.
And finally, to Emily in Burtonsville, Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I first want to thank Eunice Shriver. I became a special education teacher because of my experiences as a coach in Special Olympics, and it's been a really great career for me. But I wanted to highlight one of the campaigns that Special Olympics did starting, I believe, this year. I did it with my students. It was called Spread the Word to End the Word, and it was a petition to ask high school students in particular to stop using the word retard or retarded as a derogatory word. And I was just amazed at how many of the students that came to sign the pledge really didn't even understand why that would be hurtful or why, you know, it was important not to use language like that.
Tom, do you want to comment?
Well, I think what the caller said is right on target because for years these terms have been used in not complimentary ways. In many cases, they're as rude as any word that we have heard on in the public television, radio, and spoken. And this program is just another example of how we can best exhibit the qualities, the abilities of the individuals with disabilities.
Emily, thank you so much for your call. And I think we all, as a society, owe a great debt to Eunice Kennedy Shriver, not only for the establishment of Special Olympics, but to the broader understanding of what it means for individuals and for families in these predicaments. Tom Songster, George Jeschen, David Egan, Kathleen Egan, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ream.